There's an area just off the west coast of Lewis which features quite a cluster of small uninhabited islands. These islands are relatively sheltered, have lovely sandy beaches, and are a kayaker's dream. And when then I'm at home during the sad winter months and the kayak is under its tarpaulin in the back garden and all I can do is fantasize about kayaking expeditions and plan kayaking expeditions, I'll go on Google Earth and I'll put in the Isle of Lewis. And from that initial, quite distant bird's eye perspective, it will look like there are only a very small number of islands in that area off Lewis's west coast. But then I'll zoom in. And I'll zoom in a bit more. And it will become clear as I do so that what originally looked like one island over here is actually divided by channels of water and is in fact two or maybe three islands. And what had originally looked like one island over there is also in fact a couple of separate islands. And if you've used then Google Earth at all or something like it, you'll perhaps recognize the kind of thing I'm talking about. The way in which you have to zoom in order to pull apart and to distinguish what otherwise just seems unitary. And something a bit like that is going on in Genesis chapter 2. Because Genesis 1, it gives us, as it were, a bird's eye view of creation week. And a bird's eye view, therefore, of day 6 of creation week. And from that bird's eye view, it looks like we have on day 6 the creation of the land animals. And then after that, in verses 26 to 28 of chapter 1, this great culminating piece of the whole creation, and it looks like this culminating piece of the whole creation is one thing, basically. One thing which evokes in verse 27 an outburst of song. But you see, what happens in chapter 2, beginning at verse 4, is there's a zooming in. Moses was using this device long before Google Earth came along. And as chapter 2 zooms in, a couple of things happen. So first of all, days 1 to 5 just disappear from view, and day 6 entirely fills the picture. But then secondly, it becomes clear that the culminating piece of the whole creation, as I called it, is not actually one thing, it's two things. Or to put it another way, the culminating piece of creation has, in fact, its own culminating piece, which evokes in verse 23 its own outburst of song. And that's the theme, then, of verses 18 to 25. The culminating piece of the culminating piece, if you like. And this week and next week, we're looking at those verses, looking at what God brings into being in them. And we're asking the question then, why is this the culminating piece of the culminating piece? What's the big deal here? And we're answering that question in three ways. I'm going to suggest that the significance of what God brings into being in these verses is, number one, a solitude prevented. Number two, a separation produced. And number three, a spouse provided. And we're going to confine ourselves to the first of those two this evening, which takes us up to the end of verse 23, and we'll then consider the third next week, which will take us into verses 24 and 25. So without further ado, let's consider, first of all, a solitude prevented. A solitude prevented. So as Genesis 2 zooms in on day 6, we see in verses 4 to 17 a human being created. And that human being is made in the image of God. And that human being has sovereignty over the rest of creation. And that human being is in a communicative relationship with God. And we might be tempted to think, therefore, that human being needs nothing more. But if we were tempted to think that, we would be wrong. That human being does need something more. That human being has, in fact, a marked deficiency. The deficiency is solitude. And the something more which that human being needs is another human being. Because look at what God says at the beginning of verse 18. Then the Lord God said, it is not good that the man should be alone. That's such a startling phrase, isn't it, against the backdrop of chapter 1. Do you remember that repeated refrain there? It was good. It was good. It was good. It was good. I talked, didn't I, about God's gusto throughout creation week, the way in which he derives such pleasure from all these different things that he brought into being, the way in which it made him smile and it made him laugh. It's so good, it's so good, he kept thinking and saying. And of course it seems in chapter 1 that gusto reaches its zenith on day 6, because there it was good turns into it was very good, chapter 1 verse 31. And that's true then. But what chapter 2's zoomed-in perspective reveals is that before that great peak of God finding things very good, there was a trough. A trough where actually he found something in his creation not good. Where his smile temporarily turned into a frown. And where his laugh was momentarily silenced. So what causes that trough? If the sight of vegetation and fish and birds and animals produced such a positive response from him, what is it that produces such a negative response here in verse 18? Well, the answer is the sight of a single, isolated, unaccompanied human being wandering around Eden by itself. That's what briefly clouds the Creator's satisfaction. And so it is that in verses 18 to 25, God brings into being a second, additional human being. And I think it's important then that is our starting point when considering these verses. I know that what God brings into being here is not just another human being. There are other things going on here, and we'll come to those. But that should be our starting point. It's not in the first instance a particular sex of person that Adam needs. It's not in the first instance a marriage partner that Adam needs. In the first instance, it's just sheer companionship, and it's just sheer society that Adam needs. The thing that God finds not good isn't Adam being without the opposite sex or Adam being without a wife. It's simply Adam being alone. That's what God finds not good. And the primary reason, therefore, that verses 18 to 25 are so welcome, the primary reason is that solitude is thereby prevented. There now emerges a second additional human being. I think God's aversion to human solitude is worth pondering. We live, do we not, in a society today in which there's probably more human solitude than in pretty much any other society in history. People work from home. They shop from home. They do their banking from home. The local post office, where once they experienced human contact, has probably closed down. The local library has gone the same way. The local pub has also. The local high street is now a lifeless place where once busy shops are now mostly boarded up. And on that human solitude then, that I'm saying is so prevalent around us, on that human solitude, addictive behaviors feed, don't they? Unconnected, socially starved people slip easily into pornography and into gambling and into all kinds of different ills. High levels of aloneness do not make for human happiness and for human flourishing. And that's worth pondering, but I particularly want to say this. God's aversion to solitude within original humanity, that unquestionably carries over into what we might call the new humanity, redeemed humanity in Jesus Christ. God is averse to solitude amongst Christians. In other words, Christians contenting themselves with a diet of personal Bible study and listening to sermons and joining online church services, or at the most meeting physically with other Christians for one token measly service once a week, that's a really worrying trend. Let me put it as boldly as I can. Christian believer, having God is not enough. Having God is not enough. Perhaps you've never heard a preacher say that before. But it's true. You and I don't just need God. We need each other. The first human being had God. And what was God's assessment of the situation? It's not good. It's not good. So be around other Christians. You've seen, like I have, the nature programs. A pack of wolves is chasing a herd of deer. What's the approach of the pack of wolves? Do they just charge into the middle of the herd and attack it at will? No, they cleverly isolate a deer, don't they? They separate it from the herd, thus making it vulnerable and defenseless. And that's how our enemy, the roaring lion of 1 Peter 5:8, operates. He isolates a believer. He separates that believer from other Christians, thus making him or her vulnerable and defenseless. It's so striking that you read the Gospels, and in the Gospels, Jesus is almost never alone. Almost never. He prays by himself once or twice in the Gospel accounts. But almost never do we find Jesus alone. Whether it's just in ordinary day-to-day stuff, whether it's in crisis moments like Gethsemane, almost never do we find Jesus alone. And we then need to take this seriously. Don't let being an introverted character, don't let social awkwardness become a pretext for minimal contact with brothers and sisters in Christ. Your health as a Christian, perhaps even your eternal welfare, depend upon good levels of contact with other Christian folk. And the health and eternal welfare of others, they depend on them being able to have contact with you. If you withdraw, you're not only endangering yourself, but you're endangering others as well in that way. So why, I'm asking, is this second human being the culminating piece of the culminating piece of the whole creation? Well, because this second human being prevents the solitude in which the original human being would otherwise have lived. A solitude prevented. But then secondly, this evening, a separation produced. A separation produced. Throughout creation week, God has been separating. Separating day and night. Separating the waters below and the waters above. Separating earth and seas. And that's going on again here. Because what comes into being in these verses then is not simply a second human being. That, as I said, is an important starting point that we shouldn't just skip over, and we haven't skipped over that this evening. But this second human being then is also a different kind of human being, requiring, in verse 23, a different name. That first human being created in verses 4 to 17 is a man. This second human being is a woman. What does this mean then? A different kind of human being. Well, the passage answers that by way of a lovely little phrase. The woman, according to the ESV, is fit for him. Notice that phrase is there at the end of verse 18, and it's there again at the end of verse 20, fit for him. But that's not, I think, the most helpful rendering, because the Hebrew phrase is actually literally like opposite him. Like opposite him. And the woman then, this is saying, the woman fulfills two specific criteria. She's like him, and she's opposite him. So think of all those animals then, paraded before Adam in verses 19 and 20. And there's plenty of oppositeness there, isn't there? As Adam looks into the eyes of each of those animals, as he sees them all pass by him, he sees plenty of oppositeness. They don't talk like he does. They don't appreciate the aesthetic beauty of the garden like he does. They have no desire for intimate fellowship with God like he does. There's plenty of oppositeness there. But no likeness. This woman, on the other hand, she's like him. She's like him. Indeed, she comes from him in a very real sense, from his rib, so that she is bone of his bones, he says, and flesh of his flesh. By the way, it's worth noting, isn't it, that Adam clearly does not view himself as the product of a long evolutionary chain. Because in that case, he would be of the same bones and the same flesh as a whole load of other things around and about him, all the apes and the chimps. But no, he sees in the woman the first creature yet with whom he has a shared substance. Being connected in origin to another isn't old hat to Adam, because he's already connected in origin to all those hairy evolutionary ancestors swinging from the trees around and about him. No, this is a brand new phenomenon for him. He doesn't see himself as the product of a long evolutionary chain. So I'm saying then in the animals, there's oppositeness, but there's no likeness. But then suppose God had just created here, at the end of day six, he created just another male human being. In that case, there would have been likeness, but no oppositeness. Adam would have just been staring at a mirror image of himself. But this woman, she's not a mirror image of Adam. She lacks his anatomical and temperamental maleness. She has in its place an anatomical and temperamental femaleness. She's opposite him. She's like him because she talks and she appreciates aesthetic beauty and she wants fellowship with God, but she's opposite him. She's female rather than male. And this oppositeness then, it's crucial, I think, when it comes to a much misunderstood detail of our text. And I'm referring to that word helper, which again is there at the end of verse 18 and at the end of verse 20. And I guess that there are two different ways, aren't there, in which we might use the language of help. And so one is an almost patronizing way that we might use it, where someone helps by sharing a load that, if necessary, you could actually bear perfectly well yourself. So, you know, you're putting up a tent because you're camping for the night, and your young child is desperate to help you put up the tent. And so you say, well, you hold the peg bag. And I'll go round, and each time I come to a corner and there's a rope that needs to be pegged, you can hand me a peg from the bag. And so that's what you do. And at the end, then you thank your child for being such a good helper. And the child has helped, because the peg bag was one less thing that you had to carry around as you were trying to hammer those pegs in. But you could have gotten by without that help. You could have done it yourself. And so that's one way that we use the language of help, just sharing a load, but a load that actually, if need be, you could bear yourself. But then there's another way that we use this language. So you might be under a lot of stress, and then one day you suddenly notice that this is starting to affect your behavior, so that you're acting actually quite strangely and quite out of character. You turn up at work in your pajamas one day or something, and you're scared by this. I need help, you say. I'm going to see my doctor. Or the car's making funny noises. You pull over at the side of the road, quite confident that you can open the bonnet and tinker around with a few things and it'll be fine again. But then you notice that there's the smoke and there's a smell of burning, and you get rather worried by this. I need help. I'm going to call the AA. And in those contexts then, the helper isn't merely sharing the load. No, in those contexts, the helper is contributing something extra to the situation which you can't contribute because the helper has capabilities and resources which you don't. The doctor has medical capabilities and resources which you don't. And so can offer help as your mental health takes a nosedive. The AA technician has mechanical capabilities and resources which you don't, and so can offer help as your car engine falls apart. And often then, the woman, here in Genesis 2, the woman has been deemed a helper, I think, pretty much in the first sense. She shares the load, she carries the peg bag. But that doesn't do justice to this stress on the woman's oppositeness. If she's only like him, exactly the same as him, then yes, it's reasonable to conclude that she's that kind of helper, a sharing the load kind of helper. That's the only kind of helper she really could be. But if she's opposite him, and if the writer is stressing that in the very same breath as saying she's his helper, then it's far more likely she's that other kind of helper. As the man's opposite, she has capabilities and resources that the man doesn't. Capabilities and resources that he can't contribute, but which she can. And the thing that really confirms that this interpretation is almost certainly correct is when you do a word study. This Hebrew word translated helper is used 19 times in the Old Testament. Two of those instances are here. 16 of those instances refer to one particular helper. Do you know who that is? It's God. God is the one normally in view when this word is used. We sang, didn't we, from Psalm 115 earlier in our service, and it was in this Psalter translated help rather than helper, but it was this same Hebrew word, and we sang it, I think, three times. He is the mighty help or helper of God. And so often in the Psalms, but in other places as well, God is described by this Hebrew word. And is God then a sharing the load kind of helper? Is that what's in view when the psalmist celebrates God, our helper? Well, no. God, by being so different from us, he helps us by contributing what we can't. And I'm saying then that that's the kind of helper that this Old Testament word signifies. And the woman then, presumably, is that kind of helper. And so I think we need to banish then these crass ideas that we can sometimes have of self-sufficient man having woman as a convenient little servant helper beside him. No, man is not self-sufficient. Yes, he may be strong in areas where woman is weak, but equally, and this is the emphasis here, he is weak in areas where she may be strong and thereby can be his helper. But just a couple of thoughts then as we wrap this up. One is a fairly minor point, but I just find the language of verse 19 quite intriguing, where we read then that the Lord brought these animals to the man to see what he would call them. It's quite interesting language, that, isn't it? The Lord almost interested in what the man's going to call these animals. I think the idea there is that this is God kind of checking that Adam will call them modest, realistic things. That is to say, he will distinguish sharply between them and this woman about whom he's going to burst out into song. He won't burst out into song regarding any of them. He won't regard them as this great like-opposite helper that we've just been talking about. He won't overvalue and overplay them. He will give them names that are sober and that have an appropriate view of them, but he won't see more in them than is warranted. And why is that important? Well, because very soon one of them, one of those animals, is going to approach Adam, making very far-reaching, very radical suggestions to Adam. And Adam needs to be clear then that the animals are not the kind of creatures from which you should take moral guidance and theological advice. And God is checking that Adam gets this. That he sees animals as he should see them. He calls them what he should call them. He doesn't see them as bigger and better and more important than they really are. And Adam passes the test. It's only of woman that he bursts out in song, not of any of the animals. He doesn't overvalue them. Presumably the serpent is there. The serpent passes by Adam. And Adam sees the serpent for what the serpent is. And he doesn't see it as more than it is. Which itself then prompts two reflections. Number one, and I've commented on this in passing before in this series, this means God does not invite the fall to happen by putting a numpty at the helm in the person of Adam. We might think, oh, if only God had put someone else, if God had put me there instead of Adam, if God had put John Piper or Sinclair Ferguson there instead of Adam, if God had put John Knox there, why this idiot Adam who fell so easily? No, God is a responsible creator who puts Adam through tests, first of all. And he makes sure that Adam has a proper view of things. And he calls the animals what they are. And he doesn't see the serpent as this advisor and theologian and guide. God, we cannot lay the blame for the fall in that easy way at God's feet. And then reflection number two. Isn't it a reminder of how irrational sin can be? That here's Adam, and he knows that you don't listen to a serpent. He knows a serpent's just an animal. He's called it its name. He knows what it is. And yet just a short time after, he's suddenly lapping up what this serpent is saying to him. And isn't that what we are so often like? And we know what's wise and what's foolish, what's right and what's wrong, and we see clearly, and then suddenly we're caught out by sin. And we act foolishly, because sin, it takes us like that. It suddenly grabs us and hijacks us. And that's why we need to be so vigilant. Every day, vigilant. Every day, being watchful. Every day, being careful. Because here's Adam. And he's caught out in a way that you would never expect from the way that he conducts himself here in chapter 2. But then the other main thing that I want to say in closing is this, that this passage surely is a wonderful antidote to certain opposite evils. And so one then is that radical feminism, which swirls around in sections of our modern Western society, that radical feminism which basically hates men and sees men as the root of all the world's problems and encourages a sense of independence in women from men. And this passage shows clearly that woman is not independent of man. In a very real sense, she owes her existence to man. Without the sacrifice of one of his body parts, she would not be, this passage is saying. There's this close, close, dependent relationship. And so this passage, it's the antidote to radical feminism on the one hand, but then it's also the antidote on the other hand to misogyny, to that low view of women that can exist in some male circles, a disdain of the female sex. We've already talked about the kind of helper that woman is here, and that itself then is such an antidote, but also just Adam's sheer delight in woman there in verse 23. She's to be celebrated and sung of. That's what Adam is doing there. And I suppose I'm saying really then that any pitting of the sexes against each other, which has been so characteristic, I suppose, of history ever since Eden, and is characteristic very much of our modern Western culture, any pitting of the sexes against each other is to be avoided. The sexes are good. That's what our passage is saying. Maleness is good. Femaleness is good. If you're a male, thank God that you are, while also thanking him that half the world's population are not. If you're a female, thank God that you are, while also thanking him that half the world's population are not. Think of the Son of God. And the Son of God, he honors maleness, doesn't he? He honors human maleness by becoming incarnate as a man. Masculine in his anatomy, masculine in his temperament, masculine in his way of looking at the world and processing the world. He honors maleness, but he also honors femaleness, just by the way he conducts himself during his life here on earth. The way in which he converses so naturally with that woman at the well, to the surprise, you remember, of the disciples as they turn up. Oh, he's with a woman talking to her. The way in which some of his closest friends here on earth are women. Martha and Mary, in whose house he spends so much time. Mary Magdalene, who feels able to grab hold of him there in the garden on Easter Sunday morning. The way in which he has such concern even in his dying moments for his mother, Mary. And let's be a church then that is not a man's church. And let's be a church that is not a woman's church, but one which rejoices rather in the complementarity of the two, as much as in the complementarity of the land and the sea. Remember, this is the last great separation in creation. There's been these others that are wonderful. Just flying to Northern Ireland the other day, as many of you have perhaps often, and you fly over all this land, and it's wonderful seeing the land and the contours of the hills, and that's interesting and varied. And then suddenly you hit the sea, and the sea is interesting in its own way, and just the complementarity of the two is a beautiful thing. And the complementarity of men and women, maleness and femaleness, it's the same. And we should, as Christians, rejoice in that. I read earlier on Romans 16. Why did I read a list of names? Well, isn't it wonderful there, the way in which Paul writes to that church? And he knows all these people, and men and women are interspersed throughout that passage. Begins with a woman, Phoebe, but then all these men, all these women, Rufus's mother, so-and-so's sister. And it's not awkward then, and Paul doesn't kind of feel he has to list all the men first and then move on to the women, or the other way around, or exclude one, but he just naturally, his mind goes to that person who's a man and that person who's a woman. And it's not impossible, in fact, that even this passage is on his mind as he writes that, because certainly he'll go on just a few verses later to quote from Genesis 3. And so, what comes into being then, in these last verses of Genesis 2, this last part of day 6, what comes into being here is the concluding, culminating piece of the culminating piece of the whole creation. Why so great? Why so welcome? Why so fantastic? Well, because it means that there's a solitude prevented. But it means, too, there's a separation produced, a beautiful separation. Because this isn't just another human being. It's a like-opposite human being. It's a woman. And so there's this wonderful separation in God's creation between these two complementary sexes. May we ponder these things and be blessed in so doing. Amen.